On the Empire podcast this week, film stars don't die in Liverpool. No, they live and appear on the Empire podcast instead. That's right. We have the legendary Annette Bening on the podcast this week, plus the Oscar-winning screenwriter from Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan, here to talk about Howard's End. Ooh, we're misses. All that and more on the movie podcast that's up to its elbows in marmalade. Lovely marmalade. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning and a really cool breeze on my neck, which is quite disconcerting.
That's me. Sorry.
Is that you? How we? But you're over there. Maybe it's Keanu Reeves.
I can throw my breath.
Cool breeze across the mountains. Cool breeze in the podcast booth. That could be it. That could be it.
He's behind you right now.
I don't want to look in case he is, but I also don't want to look in case he isn't.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a conundrum.
It's a toughie.
It is a toughie. A keanundrum. Anyway, you've heard one of the colleagues of such lethal cunning. It is, of course, our geek queen, our geek queen, Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. You know, I haven't done a supernatural thing for you for the last 2 weeks.
I know, and I appreciate it.
Yeah. Do you wonder why that may be?
Is it because you've run out of the very limited store of knowledge you have about Supernatural and also the stuff you've made up about it?
Everything I know about Supernatural comes from what Chris has said, which is probably a bad thing.
Yeah.
What do you know about it? This is Nick DeSemley, by the way, our Jurassic World
Hello.
Co-star. Don't look him in the eyes, everybody.
Never look me in the eyes. My vision is based on eye contact.
Sure.
My vision's based on smell.
Yeah.
Smell it with your eyes.
Who's excited That's about true. The Jurassic World 2 trailer, which I feel is going to drop soon?
Yeah, do you think it's going to be dropping soon? I imagine some of the big trailers are going to be start dropping this side of Christmas.
Yeah.
I would imagine the John Lewis advert is one. The Marks and Spencer, have you seen the Marks and Spencer Christmas advert this year?
Yeah.
It is virtually an advert for Paddington 2. That is no bad thing,
as far as
I'm concerned.
Okay. Has it not been quite controversial?
It's been controversial because a bunch of fuckwits think that Paddington... So if you haven't seen the Marks and Spencer Christmas advert...
It's not controversial because of anything Paddington does.
No, Paddington is fine.
Paddington is a delight.
He hasn't gone R-rated.
No, he hasn't. Creepy Paddington has not returned. Do you know why it's controversial, Nick?
I don't know.
Okay, so I'll tell you. So the Paddington, the Marks and Spencer Christmas advert this year features Paddington, voiced either by Ben Whishaw himself or by someone who sounds alarmingly like Ben Whishaw, and... He interrupts a burglar on Christmas night, Christmas Eve, and mistakes him for Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. And so takes him through Windsor Gardens, putting presents back and bringing warmth and love and joy into people's lives and turning the burglar completely around because he sees what it is to give people joy when they unwrap the presents under the tree. And so at the end of the advert, Paddington hugs, says, "Oh, thank you, Mr. Claus," to the burglar, and the burglar goes, "Thank you, Paddington," and hugs him, and it's a lovely, heartwarming moment. And literally, this 90-second advert nearly made me cry. It's I don't know where Paddington is just hitting me my sweet spot right now, but people on the internets, but some people think that the burglar says, "Fuck you, Paddington," at the end of
what?
The advert.
Come on.
Have you not read this?
No.
Wow.
So some people think, because it's quite garbled, because he's hugging him and he goes, "Thank you, Paddington." And I don't know any circumstance under which "thank you, Paddington" sounds like "fuck you, Paddington," which is clearly what they think he says.
Also, come on, people. Context, okay? Context matters. And I think we need to, in this day and age, not be complete twits.
It's just a hard stare for all those people.
Super hard
right?
stare.
It's just not the done thing. Aunt Lucy would be so upset with these people.
I mean, if you'd said there was a controversy about sort of, you know, commercialising Paddington or something like that, I would have been like, I mean, okay, I really enjoyed the ad, but I see it.
Yeah, I can see that
but,
as well.
But this, that's just stupid.
Yeah.
In what universe do they think that Marks and Sparks is going to put "fuck you" in their Christmas ad? Who... honestly, for a second, believes that is plausible. Like, it just, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unlikely to get red banned, I'd say, the Christmas advert, but I don't know.
How do we get onto this?
It's hard to say.
Trailers. So you think...
I just think we'll get some trailers soon for some summer 2018 biggies, and I'm hoping Jurassic World 2 will be there.
Okay, I mean, that's all very well, but not Justice League, the other one, Avengers Infinity War... Yep. Come on.
Yeah.
Seriously, come
That's
on.
That's the one you're most looking forward to.
Yeah, 100%.
Does and it have dinosaurs
not,
in it?
If it's not on the front of Star Wars, I'm going to wait until the end of the film and then I'm going to riot.
I think it will be. I think it will be. And I think they were holding off on releasing that trailer. Because I think the trailer is, by and large, going to be the Comic-Con footage. And I think they were holding off on releasing that because of, not everyone has seen Thor Ragnarok, so I'm going to tiptoe very carefully around this. But because of, I would say, a modification of the appearance of one of the Avengers.
Well, we've all seen his haircut, Chris.
Yes. I'm talking about his big hammer, Helen.
Good Lord.
I know.
Very personal.
As you know.
Wouldn't expect that in the trailer either.
It's a subject on which I'd like to expound.
So hang on. So Thanos is getting a new haircut. What else?
Yeah. It's okay. Like, and someone's getting a big hammer. It's like DIY SOS, but with superheroes. It's going to be...
So you've seen this footage. You were in Hall H. I haven't seen it.
Have you not?
I was near Hall H, but not inside it.
Oh, man.
And it was amazing.
It was fantastic. Yeah, but...
What's your favourite bit? Or is that a spoiler?
It's in my sweet spot, isn't it? I think my favourite bit was... I won't give away too many spoilers. If you want to hear us discuss some of what happens in that footage, it is in the Thor Ragnarok spoiler special, which is out right now for your ears entertainment. But one of my favorite moments was watching it in Hall H, and every time a new character appeared, like 6,500 people just lost their minds. Like literally every time a character just appeared in screen.
And there's quite a lot of characters. Like it's more than Twitter, right?
I'll be honest, it got a little annoying because this was like a 2.5 minute, 3 minute thing, and people were just screaming every time a minor character appeared. But one of my favourite moments, there's a cool bit with Doctor Strange interacting with Star-Lord in an actionary kind of way, which was cool. But it was literally just Steve Rogers stepping out of the shadows into the light. And
metaphor.
That's all he does, yeah. And revealing that Cap in this movie has dark hair and a beard, because he's been on the run for 2 years, presumably. And people just lost their minds. You're just applauding facial hair at this point.
Yeah. I'm 100% with that.
I've been in that room and seen people applaud fonts. So I've seen Kevin Feige come out and he's revealing the font for, Black Panther was. Yeah. People just applaud the font wildly.
But he doesn't go, please, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Helvetica. He doesn't do that.
It's a way better font than that. Nobody would applaud Helvetica.
Well, no, it's a documentary.
Yeah.
There's a whole documentary on Helvetica.
Is there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe it is worth some light scattered applause. But
I think Marvel's at the point now where they could reveal the title of a movie in Comic Sans and get away with it. Dingbats.
I mean, Thor Ragnarok wasn't that far off, so...
It wasn't, was it?
It could happen.
They could give it a go. Like, just Feige goes, I knocked it up myself, lads, last night, got a little drunk, if I'm honest with you, and this is what it's going to be. And it's like, Avengers!
Yeah. I still think there's going to be a font movie. Eventually, Hollywood will really run out of ideas. We've had an emoji movie. There will be a font movie.
I'm hoping that the emoji movie killed the chances of us seeing a font movie.
Didn't it do well?
I hope not. I had to sit through it and review it, and I'm still scarred a little.
I think it did. I think it did. But yeah, I think you're right. Avengers is going to drop for Christmas. We're going to see Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. What are the biggies next year? What are the other ones, very quickly, that we haven't... We haven't even got on the question yet.
Well, Black Panther we've already done, and...
Gosh. Han Solo, right?
Han Solo.
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting. Solo. That's got to be with Star Wars, right? It's got to be.
You'd think. What are the other big ones?
What's the Warner Brothers
Rampage. I don't know why that's coming to my head.
Skyscraper.
Skyscraper.
Is there a Fantastic Beasts at the end of next year? End of next year,
there
right?
There is a Fantastic Beasts.
Is there another Justice League type movie next year? We haven't got Wonder Woman until 2019.
Aquaman.
I wonder...
I think we'll see some Aquaman soonish.
I think you're right. I think they'll want
next week.
They'll want to capitalize on the enormous bounce of popularity the character's bound to experience after Justice League. There's also X-Men Dark Phoenix. There's loads of stuff. New Mutants.
We had that trailer already, though, so forget I said that.
Deadpool 2, Star Wars Episode 9.
All about Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. And although J.A. Boner, I...
Are you in it?
On the week, I'm not in it.
Okay. So what you're saying indicates
that we know of.
A teaser trailer that's going to focus entirely on Edmund.
It's just me stepping out of the darkness into the light. And nobody applauding. I tweeted a poster for a Tom Selleck 80s movie on the weekend, and J.A. Boner replied with the poster for a different 80s Tom Selleck movie, which is of no interest to anyone, but shows that,
So he follows you on Twitter?
He does. That's all I want. That's That's all I wanted to say.
So this, hang on a second. So this whole segment was just a pretense so you could reveal that you were followed on Twitter by Juan Antonio Bayona.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, that's been exposed.
Anyone famous follow you this week, Helen? Anyone?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Yeah. Sorry.
No Des O'Connor?
Well, who is?
I don't think he still follows me. Should I check?
No.
Des O'Connor?
Des O'Connor.
Follows you on Twitter?
Anyway, let's move on. We have a question. We have a question. And this question will allow us to cover off one of the big news stories of the week as well.
Okay.
And it is a question from at Michael Axe, at MW Axe. And he says, in light of the revelations about Kevin Spacey and others, does it affect the way you see their prior work, e.g. Usual Suspects, even though those films represent many other people's work too? And the Kevin Spacey story is ongoing and developing, and you know, obviously a couple of weeks ago we said I thought we'd be talking about the fallout of the Harvey Weinstein thing for a few weeks yet, and I don't think it's going to show any signs of slowing down. And the big revelation this week in regards to the Kevin Spacey accusations and allegations that are flying around is that he has been cut out of completely cut out of Ridley Scott's All the Money in the World, in which he was going to star as J. Paul Getty. And he's going to be replaced by Christopher Plummer. The other kicker for this is, of course, that the movie is coming out on the 22nd of December. And so Ridley Scott, the fastest man in the West, is going to have to do it again. And he's brought back his principal cast and his creatives, including Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams. And he's going to shoot the scenes that Spacey shot again.
This is unbelievable, by the way. Yeah, this is because he decided this apparently late last night. Sony got a call from Ridley Scott saying, I'm bringing in Christopher Plummer to do
this. Yeah, these are the reports.
But even if you look at the trailer, there's a shot of Kevin Spacey in all his makeup in Egypt. You know, this isn't just the scenes that were done in a room. He's shot around the place.
Yeah.
How the hell are they going to do this?
Well, I mean, if they're going to do it, it's going to be Ridley Scott because he is the fastest draw in the West.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I think we've all been on set of his films, mm-hmm. and you see how quickly he moves from one setup to the next. Like, he is phenomenal. Mm. I wonder how big a role it was, because I got the impression that he was the sort of the figure in the background that everyone else is revolving around, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's always on screen. So I feel like he's a sort of Judy Dench in Shakespeare in Love kind of a role.
9 to 10 days, apparently.
9 to 10 days, exactly. So very showy, very impressive, very important to the movie, but not actually a huge amount of screen time. Mm-hmm. And also the reports have said that a lot of those scenes are him on his own on the screen, like either on the phone or in his office or whatever else. Mm. So that, again, makes it logistically possible. Yep. The other rumour is that Ridley Scott is actually, you know, making hay while the sun shines, in a way. That's a terrible analogy. Making hay while it rains? I don't know. But he kind of wanted, some reports have said, Christopher Plummer in the first place.
Yes.
And was encouraged to go for the bigger name of Kevin Spacey. And so, you know, in some ways is potentially not that upset about it.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'd like it if they just keep cutting to like Skype footage of Christopher Plummer in his house, just literally doing the whole performance over Skype.
I think it's set in the 70s, so that would be a surprise.
Yeah.
But
I hope they don't do the prosthetics with Plummer that they did with Spacey. I don't think that you need to have the actor look like J. Paul Getty. I don't think it's essential to this. Just have Christopher Plummer be Christopher Plummer. It was the latest development regarding that film this week. It was pulled by TriStar from the AFI Fest, where I think it was going to open AFI Fest either this week or next week. And it was pulled with a statement saying that, you know, they didn't think it was appropriate. I'm paraphrasing here slightly, but they didn't think it was appropriate to open the fest in the wake of the revelations. But that they were going to hold fast with the 22nd of December release date. And this echoes actually the question from Michael Axe. To hold fast with the release date out of respect for the job done on the movie by 800 other people.
Yeah.
And not Kevin Spacey. So they didn't want Kevin Spacey to become the story.
The story. And I think, I mean, this is a film that is, you know, being released during award season. Obviously, somebody at least thinks it's an awards-friendly movie, one would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And if it comes out and the only story is Kevin Spacey stars in this and Kevin Spacey is still the subject of all of these accusations, mm-hmm. ongoing, that kills its any chances. So from a purely mercenary, purely, you know, awards point of view, it's an entirely sensible decision. From a an artistic one, I guess, if you want people to talk about your film and not, you know, a co-star's life, this is the only possible response,
yes.
I guess.
Yes.
But yeah, there are 800 people involved in all of these other films, you know, and this is the, I guess, where we come back to the question. Mm-hmm. So many people in Hollywood throughout history, as in every other industry and every other art form, have been terrible people. Mm-hmm. And we've always had this discussion, and it's always a balancing act between the artist and the art, and where do you draw the line and how do you separate them? And what are you comfortable sort of endorsing in your artist by consuming their art? Mm-hmm. And there is no right answer, I don't think. And I think it always has to be a personal decision and a personal balancing act between what you're kind of okay with. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely think it's a visceral feeling. Like I think the hardest of all his films to watch is going to be the one he won the Oscar for. It's American Beauty, because not only in that is mm-hmm. he, you know, mm-hmm. lusting after a 15-year-old the whole way through, but without spoiling anything, mm-hmm. the whole finale of the movie relates again to what he's accused of, and it is. We're just going to have to step back from that one, I think, for a little while. But, or certainly I am. Mm-hmm. But you know, your mileage may vary.
Absolutely, Nick. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to change your perception of, you know, maybe the movies where he's the bad guy and doesn't get away with it will be all right. But yeah, the movies where you're meant to be rooting for him, I don't know. I mean, it's all kind of.
I think they're relatively few and far between, and they're not the ones I would want to revisit. Pay It Forward or K-Pax or. He generally is a duplicitous, slimy guy.
I guess Usual Suspects, he's the guy with the dark secret, if that's not giving anything away.
yes. I think most people know the twist to Usual Suspects, but now I would hope. It's interesting. I haven't put this to the test yet with Spacey. I mean, over the weekend, because everything, you look at Twitter and it's Spacey, 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 mm-hmm. Spacey. And you start to think about, you start to think about the films that, you know, I love that he is in. Usual Suspects, The Negotiator, Seven, Swimming with Sharks, and Garrick Ben Ross, one of my favourite films of all time.
Baby Driver, recently. John Bernthal, I don't know if you saw, but he just basically said that, got interviewed by someone and said that Spacey was a dick on the set of Baby Driver and being nasty to people, yeah.
John Bernthal's not a man who holds back, I think, in interviews.
So, yeah.
He's a Virgo. For me, this has always been a tricky one. How do you separate the artist from the art? And I won't really know until I really put that Kevin Spacey film on. Glenn Ross is a film that I'm constantly drawn back to. It's on in the West End at the moment with a different cast, and so it's been on my mind. And I think, do I put that on, and how will I feel about watching Kevin Spacey? I don't think it will change my reaction to the film too much. But again, as Helen said, your mileage may vary. It's a tough one. But I would say that. Bear in mind as well, as Helen said, that you know this is the work of, on certain films, 100 different people, 150 different people, 300 people, whatever it is. And maybe think of them as well when you're approaching that film or that play or that book or that song, whatever it is. Not a definitive answer, but I don't think this is a topic on which there can be a definitive answer. But if you do want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, you can do so via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire podcast as Michael Axe did, and we will see it. We're on Facebook as well as Empire Magazine, and you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Time now for our first guest this week, and she is an acting legend who's been nominated for several Oscars, yet to win. She's been in the likes of 20th Century Women, which is a fantastic film. If you haven't seen that already, do check it out. The Kids Are All Right, The Grifters, Open Range, American Beauty, Bugsy, Love Affair. She is, of course, the great Annette Bening, completing our 1-2 set of the Bening household, the Bening-Beatty household. If you haven't listened to the Warren Beatty interview special from earlier this year, do check it out. It's a lot of fun. She will soon be seen as the film star Gloria Graham in Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool opposite Jamie Bell, who was on last week's podcast. Look at that. It's all happening. She came into London recently and she talked to John Nugent. So do enjoy this interview. Annette Bening.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Annette Benning. How are you?
Hi, great. Thank you. Great to be here.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So we are here to talk about film stars Don't Die in Liverpool, in which you play Gloria Graham, this real-life classic Hollywood film star. First of all, I just wanted to ask, what sort of research did you do? I imagine you just had a stack of classic DVDs and you just locked yourself away for a couple of weeks and just immersed yourself in that.
Yeah, that was great fun. She made some great movies. The Big Heat, In a Lonely Place, The Bad and the Beautiful, Oklahoma, those are sort of her classics. But then she also made some other more B movies that are really fun as well. A little more cheesy, some of them. But watching her and watching her evolve and her work on film was really a thrill. I think In a Lonely Place is my favorite, which she made with Nick Ray, who she had married. And that one with Humphrey Bogart takes place in Hollywood. It's a sort of movie story about movie people and really good. And she's terrific in it. I think Humphrey Bogart was very good to her. That was a joy. It was a joy to watch her. I have to go back and watch them again. I haven't in a while, but no, I'm a great fan.
And In a Lonely Place has that amazing line from Bogart about, I was born when I kissed her and I died when she left me.
That's right.
And which sort of reflects what this film is about, because it is like this sort of fleeting affair with this unlikely Liverpudlian Peter Turner, played by Jamie Bell.
Yes.
The real Peter Turner actually cameos in this film.
He does.
Did you turn to him for advice? Did you get any stories from him?
Absolutely. Peter Turner, who wrote the book that it's based on, was sort of the center of all of our inspiration because, first of all, he's such a lovely man. And when you meet him, when I met him, I should just say, I understood why Gloria had this extraordinary relationship with him, which I think was a very deep and meaningful one for both of them. Mm. I have a feeling she'd never been with a man like Peter Turner. I think she had been with a lot of very talented. I mean, Nick Ray was an incredibly talented, tempestuous, fascinating, bright, complicated guy. Cy Howard, who was her third husband, was known as being really funny and a great raconteur. But I think there was a lot of partying going on, a lot of drinking, and I think it was all pretty tempestuous with everyone. When it came to Peter at that point in her life, I think it was an entirely new kind of relationship. He's a very nurturing man. And the experience for him was incredibly intense, and especially with what happened at the end. And when it all sort of ended, he was left just sort of didn't know what to do with himself. And that's when he wrote this book, which is a really tasteful kind of impressionistic book about this thing that happened to him out of the blue.
Yeah. I was fascinated by your performance because it's interesting playing someone who is a real life figure and we know what they look like and what they sound like. How did you approach it? Was it an impression or was it more sort of a sense of the person rather than impression?
I tried to do the latter. I tried to just get a sense of her. I didn't want to do really an impression. Also, we don't really know. I mean, at that point in her life, there's some film of her and she did some TV shows and some like a kind of bad horror movie in the 70s, but we don't really know exactly how she was. So I just sort of culled from what I had seen and did what felt like the right thing for me. I didn't want to do an impression, but just to give a sort of sense of who she was. Mm. And that was my take anyway.
Yeah. But you do get a sense, you get these little sort of hints, these fragments of her sort of femme fatale past, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, she's got that very, you give her a bit of a pout and she has quite a high-pitched voice. And I love, there's a couple of lines, the line, I like habits, especially the bad ones, you know. Just such a sort of beautiful film noir line. Did it feel sort of like she's a character from another time, you know? She's sort of a person out of time.
Yeah, in a way, although of course, she never was that woman in any of those films. That was just a sort of an illusion. She became known for those movies. And one of the things that I was really shocked by in watching a lot of the old films was how many times she got beaten up in movies. It was just so common then.
God, yeah.
And because she was, quote, the bad girl, you know, she was the femme fatale, then it was very much accepted that that's how women could be treated, even in the stories. And I was sort of shocked in movie after movie, she's getting hit and beaten up and treated badly. So, I mean, I wish, gosh, I'd give anything to have just been able to sit down and have a chat with her, see what her life was really like. But the movie's very much Peter's movie, and it's from his point of view, and it's really that that emotional intensity that Jamie Bell brings to it that I think really he was, and Peter is, preoccupied with her in a very deep way. Whatever happened between them deeply affected him in his life, and he was able to write about it in a way that I could relate to. So then it just becomes a love story like any other in its uniqueness. It just happened to have been between these two people.
Yeah. Did you manage to speak to anyone who had met her? I read that Barbara Broccoli, who produced the film, had met Gloria and Peter when they were together.
Right, because Peter and Barbara were friends.
Right.
And in fact, Barbara was around them when they were together.
That's
and
amazing.
Met her. And she said, oh, yeah, it just seemed completely normal when you were around them. Like, you didn't think, oh, she's older, he's younger. She just said it felt very, very natural. And so then she, of course, would have known Peter when he was writing the book. Because he wrote it. He said it just sort of poured out of him after the relationship was over. And it was very difficult for him. I think it's difficult for him to this day.
It was
maybe each of us has had a relationship like that where it always sort of holds a place inside of you that nothing else ever really touches.
Mm.
It's not that you don't go on and fall in love with other people, but just the nature of that relationship. Sometimes those things do change us forever.
Mm. Yeah. It felt to me like one of the big themes of this film is how acting and fame can be sort of simultaneously intoxicating and destructive.
Yes.
And obviously you are someone who's, you know, has experienced acting in fame. Is that a similar relationship you've had with it, would you say?
I think that I've tried to negotiate it in a way that I didn't lose my sanity.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is tricky. And then some of it's really fantastic, you know, and pleasant. And when people stop and tell me that they've seen something or something meant something to them, or their mother or their kid or their husband, that's a great feeling. Mm. I really like that. So I've had a lot of the gifts of it that I really do appreciate. Being able to do things that I love, being able to pass on things that don't mean anything to me. That kind of that all means very much. You do lose a certain amount of anonymity, but I kind of feel like in the way that I live my life, I'm able to go around and do the things that I want to do pretty easily.
Yeah, yeah. The first time we see you on screen, you're doing vocal exercises. Mm. Is this a recognized? I'm not an actor. Is this a recognized acting technique? I mean, is this something that you do?
Yes, and I know the other day I was with a couple of actors who we were discussing the movie at a film festival, and they were saying, "Oh yeah, I remember that. I remember doing that." Anybody who's gone to acting school has had to do those silly vocal exercises. Yeah. Absolutely.
Do you have
it's a
favorite,
rite of passage?
Do you have a favorite tongue twister?
Let's see. A tutor who tutored a flute tried to tutor two tutors to toot. See, I can't even do it.
Very good. No, that's impressive. My goodness. A tutor who tutored
a flute. Oh, no, don't make me do it again.
Wow, okay. No, that I'm genuinely impressed. So it's shot on location, a lot of this film in London and in Liverpool. Have you ever been to Liverpool before? Was this your first time?
We took the train up before we were starting, just as a sort of field trip. We went up and we went to the house where Peter had lived.
Right.
We knocked on the door. Another family lives there now. And a young woman let us in. She was very sweet. We walked around. We went to the kitchen. Looks exactly like the one in the movie. That sort of, you know, you walk downstairs to go into it.
And
then
everywhere.
There's, we went upstairs, we went into the room where Gloria was when they were taking care of her. So, and walked around the city, and it's a great place and has a very different vibe than London.
Mm.
And Peter and his family and the way they loved Gloria and accepted Gloria, and Gloria knew them quite well. They went and visited there early in their relationship. So that's all very, very much a part of the whole story and the context, and also the eccentricity of the story, which is in the title.
Yeah. Did you have any trouble with the Liverpudlian accents?
Well, see, I don't do it, so I don't. You mean understanding
it? Yeah.
Oh, no, yeah. I love it. No, yeah. I had no trouble understanding it. And I loved it. And that's part of the whole experience of going there and being there. It was really a joy.
Yeah. And there is, the film has such a sort of, in the early parts at least, it has that sort of fizz and flirtation about your, the, you know, the early part of your relationship. I love that first scene where you first meet Jamie Bell's character and you're disco dancing around the living room. And obviously this is Jamie Bell who played, you know, the boy dancer from Billy Elliot. Tell me about that scene. I mean, what was it like to film?
So fun.
You hold your own against him
Thank
very well.
Thank you. Thank you. No, it was so fun. I could have done it all day.
Yeah.
No, we had a ball doing that. It was great. And I think it's very important in the movie, and that joy and that abandon and the craziness of it and how they met and how they connected and all of that. Yeah. Thank you. I love the scene. I love doing it. It was pure fun.
Was it choreographed, or did you just sort of let
loose?
No, we
didn't choreograph it. No, and Jamie's such a good dancer. I mean, there was a woman there who reminded us of a few of the classic Saturday Night Fever dance moves, but you can see Jamie doesn't need any help.
Not at all, no. So you've been acting in movies now for, I mean, it's not polite to say how long, perhaps, but
I don't mind.
It's been a while, let's say. And you've built up such an impressive body of work. You know,
there's
been so many interesting films across your career.
Thanks.
I just wanted to ask, like, how do you approach each new project? Like, what makes you say yes to your agent? What is it that...
The writing is everything, and the writing catches my eye and also just sort of preoccupies me. And definitely the director, because film is the director's medium. You're really there to serve them and to try to get their, you know, what's in their head out. It's a collaboration, definitely. But in the end, you know, you walk away and they edit the film. So that for me is actually a great pleasure. And it's kind of an adventure, because each time people approach things differently. So I like that. I like that journey of trying to sort of figure out the way in which we're going to do, because each project is so different.
Mm.
And that that search I find more and more interesting. It makes me want to continue. And I'm lucky I only have to do things I really love and find things that, and with people, it's all about the people and the connections, and being very connected to other people is a deeply satisfying thing. It makes life worth living, and it makes the projects worth doing when you're really connected to people you respect and that teach you something and that you learn from. And so that really interests me, especially about film acting. I love that. It took me a long time to really feel like a legitimate film actor.
Really?
Because I'd done so many plays, and that was really how I understood acting, was being up on my feet and going from the beginning of the story through the end every time you do it, and sitting down quietly and doing two-minute scenes for a while just felt really alien to me and funny. And now I really love it, and I understand that the luxury the camera brings.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was going to ask, you know, what's, if anything, has changed since you first started out? If you approach things differently, or if, you know, you look at things in a different way.
There's a kind of, there's a place of not knowing you want to get to. There's a place where your mind is, you're not really thinking about anything. And for those of us with minds that chatter all the time, I don't know if yours does, but mine certainly does. You know, you do the research, you do the thinking and the listening to the music, and in this case, watching movies, talking to people. But then in the moment, you want to hopefully be just in, like we are right now, in the moment with another person in the same room, listening and taking from them. So that process is fascinating to me. And then trying to surprise oneself. It's easier to plan, and there's something in the psyche which encourages one to plan, because then in some mistaken way you feel safer. But what you want to try to find is surprise. So when the camera's rolling, something happens that maybe nobody anticipated.
Right.
And that's fun to try to find. You don't always get there, but you try. And when you have good people around you, and it's worth trying to trying to find that, and just to maybe then someday somebody's in a movie theater and they're watching something and they're moved.
So do you like feeling like you're not sure what's going to happen next?
Yes.
Do you like that sort of element of danger?
You try almost? To cultivate that.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you do know to a degree. The yeah. cameras are there. They've been set up. The lighting's set up for yeah. a certain place. So it's illogical in a way. But yeah. in fact, if you can, yeah, maybe something might happen that nobody knew about or nobody thought about that would be of value. And and in films, that can be a small detail. And that can really help kind of pique an interest and make something happen that the camera can see.
Yeah. I think I'm almost out of time. I just wanted to ask quickly, are you aware you're on a T-shirt?
What?
Have you heard about this?
No.
I'm going to show you a photo. I'm afraid I don't have one in person. There's a thing called Girls on Tops, and it's literally just your name
oh,
in big black letters.
I'm very flattered.
And all the film hipsters are wearing them now. This is like the latest
thrilled.
Craze.
I'm thrilled.
Yeah. just to let you know.
I'm really flattered.
Yeah.
Thank
so
you.
if you mix within the cool young film journalist circles, then you will see that sort of T-shirt.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
And on that note, Annette Bening, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For your time.
It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so that was Annette Bening, and it's now time to talk about this week's movie news. What has been happening apart from the stuff that we have already talked about?
Well, I think the big movie story is about Universal's monsters. So obviously, The Mummy earlier this year was announced as the first of a sort of shared universe of Universal monsters, with the plans for The Invisible Man, Bride of Frankenstein, and so on, kind of coming down the line behind it. Those appear to have been, at the very least, shelved, let's say, because Alex Kurtzman and Chris Morgan, who were sort of creatively in charge of the whole thing, have apparently left. And it's kind of going nowhere. Now, it's not clear that it will definitely die. One possible option is handing it over to somebody else. Somebody like Jason Blum was suggested. Or finding someone else to kind of step in and run it all. They say, we've learned many lessons throughout the creative process on Dark Universe so far, and we are viewing these titles as filmmaker-driven vehicles, each with their own distinct vision. We're not rushing to meet a release date, and we'll move forward with these films when we feel they are the best versions of themselves. So who knows?
This is interesting. Just give it to Guillermo del Toro. Just give it to him.
I mean, that seems awesome.
Hand him the keys to the kingdom.
He kind of just did Creature from the Black Lagoon in a way.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I would have loved to have seen his version of that one. Yeah, I just think they with The Mummy, they just made it needlessly convoluted, I thought.
Yeah.
It could have been very simple. I think you were talking ages ago on the podcast, Chris, about speculating whether Tom Cruise was going to be playing Van Helsing. And I think if he had just played Van Helsing and gone up against The Mummy, that would have been a more fun film, I think. Just make it a straightforward adventure film rather than trying to get themselves tangled in.
I think they just front-loaded the mythology too much. Like, you know, make your first film and then build your universe. Don't sort of run before you can walk name the start of another first film in a shared universe.
Yeah, they didn't do a great job of building up the mythology. They just show you the whole of Prodigium, everything about it, straight away. They show you, you know, Russell Crowe turning into the monster within the first hour of the film.
They call their big organization Prodigium. I mean, you're not off to a great start, are you? I think this whole thing was misbegotten from the start. I think that they had perhaps put the wrong people in charge. They certainly were approaching it from the wrong angle. I don't think this should have been a series of $100 million plus blockbusters. The idea that Jason Blum and Blumhouse might be involved is great, because there is a guy who can get gold, for the most part, out of $5 and $10 million budgets. And that's what these should be. They should be low down, not gritty, that's the wrong word, but they should be low budget horror films with the emphasis on actually being scary.
Well, I don't know. I'm not against a big budget horror movie. But that wasn't what this was.
I just don't think they work. You'll instantly prove me wrong by citing five recent examples.
But I think
once you get over American Werewolf in Paris.
I think once you get over a certain budget level, horror doesn't work. Horror has to have a certain. I think the budget has to force some ingenuity from the filmmaker.
Is Jaws not technically a big budget horror film?
And weren't the original Universal Horrors essentially?
I don't know if they were big budget. I mean, you look at Dracula, certainly the first Dracula with Bela Lugosi, and it's largely one set being reused.
I mean, it is, but at the same time, like, it was fairly big budget, I think, by the standards of the day, a lot of those films, and you got big names increasingly, or certainly the stars became big names, perhaps.
Yeah.
So it's not quite the Blumhouse.
No. But what I mean is, avoid the Mike Nichols wolf treatment, avoid the Wolfman treatment. Basically, anything that's got a werewolf in it, Van Helsing, you know, which could have been a great schlock masterpiece, was a disaster piece. Or as Simon Crook came up with in the next issue of Empire, Master Piss, which I thought was pretty funny. Okay. I think the horror, for the most part, has to have filmmakers bumping their head against the ceiling of budget to force themselves to come up with some sort of solutions to things. And also, I don't know, big budget in horror movies is usually conflated for me with CG. And CG in horror films, for me, doesn't always work.
No, I agree.
Yeah, that's
right. I agree. CG is not particularly scary. Neither are zombie security guards named Alan. It was Alan?
Don't you diss Alan. He is my character of the year. He's amazing.
I think that might have been one of the many missteps that the Mummy took.
He died so that Tom Cruise could kind of semi-live. I didn't understand the movie, I'll be honest with you. Hey, if you want to check out the spoiler special with Richard Alex Kurtzman, who has now left the Dark Universe, then you can do so. It's also on your podcast listening device. What else has been happening?
I think we've all dreamed, haven't we, of seeing The Lord of the Rings on the screen. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know if you know this book, but J.R.R. Tolkien wrote it. It's a very big, sprawling book. So naturally, its home would seem to be TV. And thus, Amazon is apparently considering making a TV adaptation of it.
This is exciting because I think we're going to get Tom Bombadil. I think we might get a bottle episode with Tom Bombadil. Just trying to
open a bottle.
Tom Bombadil.
Tom Bombadil opening bottles.
We could finally visit the Barrow Downs. We could finally see the Scourging of the Shire, which actually, narratively, I have a whole problem with.
Yeah.
I guess.
How many breakfasts are we going to get? It's not going to be just two.
That's a good point.
I want to see an Olympus Bread origin episode. I want to see where it comes from. I want to see, I want to have an Amazon, I want to see a Lord of the Rings cookery show, like MasterChef, right? But with Lembas bread.
Well, I actually have seen the scripts to this, and I can tell you that the first half of the first season is entirely party planning.
Oh yes,
yeah.
And then when
they break for Christmas, we have the big party.
Seasons
3 through 10 are just walking.
Listen, I'm okay with this. This sounds to me like most of Channel 4's afternoon scheduling already. I mean, you could have four in a bed with the four hobbits and, you know, not in the sex way, obviously, that would, you know,
be wrong.
It would, but also,
would
so
it?
Right. I don't know. I don't know. This sounds like interesting news for anybody who thought that the Lord of the Rings movies were too short.
It's going to be like Autumn Watch, but just in Mirkwood.
Bill Oddie looking.
Who thought that? Never mind. I just think this is interesting because apparently, you know, Amazon wants their own Game of Thrones, and that's kind of where this is coming from.
Really?
But, I mean, speaking as a nerd, there are so many epic fantasy series out there with multiple books that haven't already been brilliantly filmed and won all of the Oscars for all of the people of New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not sure. I know it has a lot of name recognition, but, you know, you don't need that to begin with. Game of Thrones was known to us nerds, but it was not known outside it before it started. So what you do is you get something else and you do it well. Wheel of Time is still up for grabs, for goodness sake. The Belgariad, if you want to, you know, something that the kids can watch. There are so many options, not all of which involve Terry Goodkind, which would be dreadful. There's got to be options. Silmarillion, if you want to stick with Tolkien, there's other versions, exactly.
I don't want to judge this before it happens.
But that's doing it
anyway. Never know, but I'm going to, because I think this is a terrible idea. I just think there are so many ways you can get this wrong, as I think the animated version showed.
I don't know, instead of Giant Eagle, they could have Amazon drones to deliver them to.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's a thing they could do.
Is it Mount Doom? I'm not up my own talking anymore.
Yes, it is.
I think the films were so definitive in every area, and they got it so right. And The Hobbit showed, you know, even the same exact people trying to pull it off. It was like lightning. I think it worked once. They couldn't even recreate it. I could well be wrong, but I think this is a bad idea.
I agree 100% with that. I could also be wrong, but I think they shouldn't do it and should do something else that's completely different.
I'm
but also has dragons.
Ooh,
Temerara. Do Temerara. I've been talking about this for years.
I think Peter Jackson has the rights.
I think he certainly did.
I think there are things that really work well on the small screen. I mean, Reacher would work really well on the small screen, but I'm not sure that Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones is obviously massive, but it just feels to me like you're going up against three of the most beloved films of all time. Why would you even do that?
Yeah.
Because the effects are never going to live up to what they were.
Oh, well, no, some of the effects haven't aged that well. So there's moments that they could definitely do better.
Oh, there's the bit where Orlando Bloom's surfing on that.
Yeah.
Is it Oliphant he's surfing on? Timothy Oliphant, and he doesn't look happy about it. And he's like,
which is weird because Timothy Oliphant is the best.
You'd surf on him, wouldn't you, Helen?
That's a bit personal.
I actually think the Lord of the Rings effects have generally dated. Sorry, we're going off on a tangent.
No.
But they generally dated better than even The Hobbit, because I think
they are better than The Hobbit.
He threw in so many practical things. I know a lot of it's digital, but...
you're right. It has generally...
But I agree there are some ropey, like glass surfing shots.
Anything else real quick?
Steven Soderbergh, while we're on TV, has come up with something. Have you guys seen the trailer for Mosaic?
That's what he talked about on our interview special, which you can hear on your podcast listening device.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay. So go listen to that.
Go listen to that and go watch the trailer. I haven't seen it myself, and I also haven't seen the trailer for Steven Spielberg's The Post, which stars Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. Those two losers, what a league, honestly.
That looks awesome, and I can't wait to see it. Just very quickly mention, we talked, I think, last week only about Julianne Moore signing up to My Life on the Road, where she would play Gloria Steinem. Carey Mulligan is reuniting with her Mudbound director, Dee Rees, for a film called An Uncivil War, where she will play Gloria Steinem. So that's exciting. Who would have thought we'd have dueling Gloria Steinem films? That is a thing that is happening.
And The Boys has been greenlit by Amazon, of Amazon, which is the Garth Ennis comic book. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's been a long time since Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg have kind of been talking about doing it. I remember ages ago there was talk of them trying to do it as a film with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, but it seems to be happening now as a TV show, which is exciting, and it's basically about a group of vigilantes who have to take down corrupt superheroes. So when superheroes go bad, these guys come after them. And I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. And they've also cast the boy for Shazam, which I think we're all excited about.
Yes.
You remember it's part of the
DCEU.
Yes.
Absolutely. Did we talk about this last week?
Asher Angel will be playing Billy Batson, who will transform into Captain Marvel, when he says Shazam.
This is the one where it's going to get confusing. And Quicksilver's in this. They should have a third Quicksilver just to be in this movie, just to really confuse people. We're not talking about the rumors that Disney had held talks to purchase 21st Century Fox and 20th Century Fox, which of course would have thrown the cat amongst the pigeons for all kinds of reasons.
The X-Men among the Avengers.
Huh? Yeah, but because at the moment the talks aren't successful, they were held, but they're not going ahead. So until there's something concrete for us to talk about, I think we'll deal with it then.
Sure.
But there we go. So that is the movie news. Don't forget the new issue of Empire is also on sale right now with Reservoir Dogs on the cover. New upcoming movie. Do check it out. And it's time now for our next guest. And the Lord of the Rings thing is interesting because, of course, that is a TV show that has a huge movie in its past. And this week on BBC One, you will be able to see a new four-part adaptation of E.M. Forster's novel Howard's End, starring Hayley Atwell.
Peggy Carter, we love you.
We love you.
We love you, Peggy Carter.
Matthew McFadyen and Tracy Ullman, of all people. And of course, there was a huge Oscar-winning movie with Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins in the past. But this new version, which is very good, I have seen it. It is written by Kenneth Lonergan. Now, Kenneth Lonergan, of course, has recently won an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Manchester by the Sea. He is, of course, also the director behind You Can Count on Me and Margaret and the screenplay for Gangs of New York and Analyze This. He's basically one of the best screenwriters in the business. So when he puts his pen to something, you sit up and you take notice. He came at the pub booth last week and we sat down. We talked about his screenwriting technique, what attracts him to projects, Howard's End, and all sorts of other stuff as well. I thought it was pretty damn fascinating, and I hope you will too. Here he is, Kenneth Lonergan. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the writer of the upcoming Howard's End miniseries and, of course, freshly minted Oscar winner, Kenneth Lonergan. How are you, sir?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. I'm not resting with jet lag in the way that you are, but...
Oh, it's not too bad.
It's not too bad? Good, good, good. We are in November, Kenny. Do you mind if I call you Kenny for the purposes of this? We're in November now, which is the type of year that you may maybe start to take a look back and take stock of the year that you've had. You've had a bit of a belter of a year, would you fair to say? How would you rate your 2017?
Well, you know, a lot happened, but most of it was all over by March, so it hasn't been quite as busy. The second half, most of 2017, it was 2016-17 that was really the busy year.
Okay.
So far, it's been a bit more peaceful since March.
Okay. So when you March came and you had won the Oscar, what did you do? Did you kick back for a while, or were you still working on Howard's End, or what happened?
A bit of both. Howard's End was pretty well underway by then. I don't remember exactly when they were shooting, but most of the script work was finished, if not all of it, and I think there was some minor work to be done, and all the work was then being done by Hedy McDonald and Playground and the BBC, so I was I just sat back and watched and was happy to let them get to it.
Do you visit the set a lot? Were you on set?
No, I didn't. You know, I traveled a lot last year, which I really enjoyed, but I think I was a bit burned out, so I didn't. And had some family issues going on at home, so I just wasn't able to come over and visit the set, which I very much wanted to do, though. They sent me rushes and various versions of scenes as they came together, and I was very tempted to come over, but I just wasn't able to.
So how did it come into your life, Howard's End, in this first? Because you're the writer on it, you wrote all four episodes, mm-hmm. But you're not the showrunner, per se.
No, I'm not at all. I'm just the writer on this. Colin Callender asked me if I he pitched the idea to me a couple of years ago, I guess, mm-hmm. and I had to think about it a lot, but I always think about whatever. I'm not the impulsive type. So I thought about it a bit, and we talked about it quite a bit, and then I ended up writing it.
What was it appealed to you?
It's just such a good story. It's the period is very interesting to me. I'm very interested in history, and I've always wanted to write a period piece, and here was this great novel, which is so rich, not just in the period, but in the private life of the characters, and the novel's very thoroughly investigates both the so many levels, the social conditions, the three different classes that are represented in the film, also the emotional lives of the characters, and the characters are so unusual and so unusually rich that it was quite a pleasure to dramatize, and there's plenty to latch onto and get interested in.
So you mentioned there that you work as a playwright, and is that what you saw yourself doing when you were growing up and you wanted to become a writer? Was it playwright first? And did movies happen along, not accidentally, but as a result of that, as a byproduct of that, in a way?
Yeah, kind of. I went to my high school had a very good drama program and a very talented drama teacher, and I got interested in the theater in 9th and 10th grade, 14, 15 years old. And I just wanted to be a playwright until I was in my 30s, and then I finally wrote a film. I then went into screenwriting as a way to make a living so that I could support my playwriting, which wasn't making a living. And then I got interested in directing as a way to protect the script at first, because having worked as a professional screenwriter, I knew that there's no protection for a script, and you have to treat your screenwriting work with much less personal attachment than your playwriting work. And when I realized it was possible to direct a small, low-budget movie, I wrote my first script as a screenwriter the same way I would as a playwright, with love and with a feeling of attachment to it. Mm-hmm. I always try to do a good job for other people, but it's a different discipline.
Of course. So have you been through that horror show of having your work, your film work, picked apart by producers and rewritten by others?
I have not, I have had scripts picked apart and rewritten by others, but it wasn't a horror because those scripts
you weren't attached to.
That's what I expected, and that's what I signed up for. And so, you know, it's common knowledge what happens to scripts in Hollywood, and they pay you quite well for the privilege of of rewriting you completely and throwing it out and having it never be made or whatever other things might happen to it. So in a way, it was very good training because I knew what would happen to a script I cared about if I didn't protect it in some way.
Yes.
So each of the three films that I've done, protecting the script was never an issue because I made sure that without the script being completely, without my power over the script being complete, that I wasn't interested in going forward with the project, and that was clearly understood with each of the three sets of producers that I've worked with and the financiers as well. And I've never had a serious or disturbing discussion about the script on either of any of the three films that I've done.
Okay, interesting. Does it work the other way? Because I know that you've done script doctor work in the past, mm-hmm. and you've contributed to some films uncredited. Mm-hmm. As a writer, how does that make you feel when you are rewriting someone else? Do you approach it from the same viewpoint almost?
Well, no. I mean, see, I would never rewrite someone. I would never rewrite someone's film if they were in creative control of it. I would never mm-hmm. rewrite someone's play. I would never be so presumptuous. But a screenplay is a bought and sold commodity that's up for grabs for anyone to rewrite, and anyone who sells a screenplay to a studio like myself knows what he or she is getting into. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't fault any of the writers who were hired to rewrite my material. I don't like the system. I think it's wasteful. I don't think it leads to particularly good results. I don't like the disrespect with which scripts are treated mm-hmm. in commercial film production. I think it's wrong. But maybe this is morally reprehensible, but that's the sea we all swim in, and I'm
yeah.
I if someone sold their script to a studio and they kick them off the script and hire me to rewrite them, I have no mm-hmm. problem doing it. It's been done to me. I've done it to others, but I feel it's the producers and the financiers who are genuinely responsible. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's a really horrible attitude to have, but you have to make a living somehow.
No, absolutely. And of course,
one exception was Gangs of New York, which was a film. I was the fourth of four writers, and brought on by Scorsese, who was the creative force behind the whole thing. And I didn't feel like I was. That was different. That was not a committee. That was a genius controlling things.
And was that a page one rewrite for you, or how did that work?
No, it was very very. Very specifically targeted. They wanted some work on some of the characters. They wanted work on the dialogue, meaning Marty Scorsese did, mm-hmm. and then I also did some structural work that I thought was needed, and they were happy to accept it. And a lot of what I did stayed in the film, and then they adjusted some of it. But that was a wonderful experience. It wasn't the normal Hollywood. Free-for-all.
Were you the writer on set?
I got there a couple of weeks before they started shooting. They were in a quite desperate straits. Hussein Amini, who's an uncredited writer on the film, did a really good job mm-hmm. before me, but he had to go on and do a film of his own. So I was brought on two weeks ahead of the beginning of the shoot, and I rewrote the script about 2 weeks ahead of the schedule for 3 months, and everyone else was freaking out and incredibly anxious, and I was Shinichi Ta rewriting for Martin Scorsese and Daniel Day-Lewis and Leonardo DiCaprio having a wonderful time.
Was it seat of the pants type stuff though, Kenny? Because I spoke to a director, I won't name him, but recently on a fairly big movie, and I said, "How's it going?" They were shooting for a couple of months by this point, and he said, "Yeah, it's going well. We've got the beginning and we've got the end. Not so sure about the middle, but we'll get there."
This was a bit more structured. They had the story was laid out quite well, and the work that had been done was quite good. And then they'd lost their way a bit because I think there were too many cooks in the kitchen. Mm. And so my work was pretty controlled. I cut about 10 or 20 pages out of the script. I changed around some of the characters. The script was quite episodic that I got, and I tried to link the events together a bit, make them force each other dramatically a bit more, and I tried to put in some humor. Mm-hmm. And you know, and you have to accomplish, but I think it was very, for some reason my memory of it is not that it was, even though it was such a tight schedule, it was a pretty methodical process. I would have a meeting with Marty, then I would have a meeting with the actor who was in the scene, that we'd all talk it through, mm-hmm. then I would rewrite the scene, show it to Marty first. Once he and I were both happy once he was happy, really. I mean, I was usually happy if he was happy. Then we'd show it to the actors involved, we'd get their input. If I had to go back and rewrite again, we'd go through the same thing until everyone was happy. But it was a pretty good system, and it clipped along fairly well, and everyone seemed happy.
Indeed. I have to ask you, because Daniel Day-Lewis is obviously about to deprive us of his talents, unless, of course, he changes his mind. What was that experience like working with him and writing that amazing character?
I love him. I loved him. He was so nice to me. He would come visit me in my little cubicle and with his mustache and his costume and his New York accent, and he was so gentle and kind, and we became quite friendly, and I loved working. And he would, if he didn't like something, he'd be very serious and concerned, and then say that this part was difficult. And if he liked something, one of the greatest compliments I ever got was, there was a little speech that I wrote, and he came into my office and he said, "This is poetry, Kenny." And I never dreamt of writing poetry, and I don't know that I think it was poetry, but the Daniel Day-Lewis telling you your dialogue is poetry is pretty nifty.
That's amazing.
So I absolutely loved working with him.
Was it can you remember the scene in question?
Yes, he's describing how he murdered Leonardo DiCaprio. He's describing his murder of Liam Neeson.
Okay.
He's sitting, it's a scene where he's sitting wrapped in an
American flag, yeah.
And he's actually describing how he plucks out his own eye. He said, "I plucked out my own eye and sent it to him wrapped in blue paper," something like that,
mm-hmm.
which he quite liked. Again, I didn't call it poetry, he did.
Sounds poetic to me. I just have to ask one last thing about him. I mean, obviously he has this air of mystique around him, and you say he came with his New York accent. I'm just intrigued by the how far he goes as a method actor, and how that affects his relationship with a writer. Are you talking to Daniel Day-Lewis, or are you talking to Bill the Butcher when he comes
well,
in?
Well, everybody called him Bill. I called him Daniel, and he didn't mind. I found it a little silly calling him Bill. But I don't think it was done in quite the way that people think. I mean, he'd come on the set and Marty would go, "Bill!" You know, it was sort of a... I never got the feeling like I hadn't met Daniel Day-Lewis. I think, you know, when you're playing... A lot of actors have trouble just switching it on when the camera's on. So, you know, they will be in the mood of the part, or if they're doing an accent, they'll do the accent during the day, because they're all different, but it's whatever makes it comfortable for you to do the scene. So if it's comfortable for him to be that person all day long, and so that there's not a huge shift when the camera starts rolling and when it stops rolling, or if the camera jams, or if they do it again, to just go back and forth. I can see how it would be difficult to toggle your personality on and off.
Yeah, of course.
Especially when you're playing such extreme types as he plays. I actually discussed this with him at some length later on when we were having a drink together in New York. And when he's talking about my left foot, he said he felt it would be very disrespectful. He spent a lot of time in the hospital with people with cerebral palsy, and he said he felt it would be very disrespectful to hop in and out of the wheelchair when he was on the set. And he also said to me this very interesting thing with a laugh. He said maybe I'm not that imaginative, because I'm very literal, so I really have to just be that person as much as I can be, because it's hard for me to just play at it. It's hard for me to imagine it, so I have to go as far as I can in that direction. And Gangs was the only... He was himself on the weekends, because there were a couple of social events on the weekends where he would show up in his tweeds, which were his own clothes, and he'd have his English accent. But when he's on the set, he was in his Bill the Butcher mode, and he said that was the first time he had ever done that. But had done it because he didn't want to go home to his two sons, two young sons, and be this horrible murdering butcher from 19th century New York.
Daddy's home.
Yeah, exactly.
You're waking him up at 4 in the morning with the American flag wrapped around his shoulders.
Yeah, quite.
I spoke to you around the time that Manchester by the Sea was hitting the BAFTA trail, and you picked up the BAFTA and the Oscar, obviously, for this year as well. And you know, there was much talk at the time about how you were initially writing that movie and the directing that came along subsequently. After your experience in Margaret, and I don't want to dwell on that, obviously, because I imagine it's still quite painful for you, were you reluctant to get back into directing? Did you want to? Not especially.
I mean, I was tired after the long, arduous post-production battles with Margaret. They ended up... It was a more or less happy ending, I think, but
yeah.
I was very... It was strain. It was a big strain. It was stressful. It was demoralizing some degree. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever done, and to have that much trouble following it and that much trouble getting it out and that much trouble getting it distributed properly. Well, yeah. It was never distributed properly, yeah. And it's a miracle that anyone's seen it. So, with all that, I think I was demoralized more. I don't know if it's, maybe it's too fine of a distinction. I don't think I was discouraged exactly in myself, but I was demoralized about how much work you can do and have it, and how much pushback I got just trying to make the film the way I wanted to.
Of course, yeah.
So it was more just a feeling of exhaustion than anything else. But I was always planning to do more films, and I didn't quite view it as much of a personal resurrection to the degree to which some people like to characterize it.
People love a narrative, Kenny.
Yes, I know. And I'm probably stupid to be foiling that narrative, since people seem to like it so much.
It's a good narrative to stick with. Print a legend.
Yeah, there you go.
What's next for you?
I don't know. I'm working on a few different things, and I'm waiting to see which one of them will turn into something wonderful. I'm not sure which, if any, of them it's going to be.
Okay, excellent. Well, wish you all the best of that. And now, while you're here in London, are you going to satisfy the playwright half of yourself and get to see some theatre?
I'm going to try to.
Anything in
I'm
particular?
I'm here for a couple of days, so I don't know if I'll get the chance, but I don't know. I have to find something to go see. They're doing a Handel opera at the Royal Opera House. I might go see that.
Go see that. I also recommend The Ferryman.
Oh yeah,
which is the new play by Jez Butterworth. So,
oh, all right.
Yeah, check it out. 3 hours. It's good stuff. Brilliant, Kenny Lonergan. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, literally everyone in the country is going to be watching Howard's End.
Really?
Because it's on right after Blue Planet 2.
Ah, I'm not watching that.
You are a fool and a bounder. It is genuinely the greatest thing on TV. Last week was more trippy than any visual in Doctor Strange. It was about the deep. And
Doctor Strange is in it.
Doctor Strange is in it. Yeah, you know what?
Okay.
If it'll get Chris watching.
I'm fully on board. I'm very up for that now, Helen. Yes, thank you very much indeed. So Howard's End is on BBC One as of this Sunday, November 12th. Time now to discuss this week's movies, this week's big movie releases, and there's only one place to start, the one that everyone's going to be flocking to, the one that made me laugh, made me cry. It is, of course, Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. No!
Classic!
Oh!
What a misdirect!
Fake out!
Boom!
Yeah!
And that's why we win the big awards.
Do we? No!
No, we don't! Another fake out!
No, don't!
I mean, I can talk about that if you want. Should we start with it?
Do we want to start with it?
We can get out of the way and then finish on a high note.
We're not getting it out of the way. This is a movie in which hundreds of people... It's a two-star film in which... Okay, let's get out of the way. Professor Marston and the Wonder
Woman. Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. This is the story of the creator of Wonder Woman, singular, who was indeed started his career as a professor and started work developing a lie detector test. That was one of his early... sort of inventions. The one that he patented isn't the one in general use, but he was there anyway. He married young to a woman who's played in this case by Rebecca Hall. He himself is played by Luke Evans.
Maya Hansen from Iron Man 3.
Thanks, yeah.
That's the only way I can relate to things.
Oh my God, Chris, you may have a problem.
Someone said that to Tony Stark in Iron Man 2. Look how he turned out. Anyway, carry on.
Okay, so... he starts off as a psychologist, working as a university professor, but his academic career is stymied by his very unconventional personal life because he and his wife take up with his young assistant, who's played by Bella Heathcote, and they live in a sort of menage a trois, eventually. Mm. That's a little bit of a spoiler, but it's also right there in the title, so I'm not going to worry about it. Mm. So the story is really more about their relationship than about him creating Wonder Woman, although that kind of comes into it towards the end. I have to say, they've messed a lot with the truth. I've read the book on this, literally a fantastic book called The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore, which I highly recommend. This is wildly changed from that, as the director, Angela Robinson, herself has admitted.
Yeah, I think one of the relatives of Professor Marston actually has done an interview and said, disappointed at how much was made up.
Yeah, because you know a lot of the book is amazing in itself, but maybe there was just too much story there to kind of get across, and they wanted to kind of focus down on the threesome, if you will. So you know, there's some good performances, particularly from Rebecca Hall, but it doesn't feel true. Okay. Because it isn't, I think. We give it 2 stars.
2 stars. And Nick, yep. you concur with that?
I wrote the review, and I concur with my own review. But it's 2 stars.
With your review.
It's just got a sort of cheesiness and blandness about it that's quite disappointing, given its subject matter is quite radical. And there are people who enjoyed it more than I did. I just thought it was not memorable. I thought it could have been a lot more kind of interesting. There's a terrible Nina Simone cover. Over a sex scene.
Really?
Really bad.
Okay. By whom?
I don't know.
Okay, excellent. So 2 stars in for Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman, a movie that, if you ask me, maybe needs to go and sit on the lasso of truth. Because then it'll be better. I guess. A little bit. Okay, so opening in fairly limited release this week across the country and in London is a Florida project. It will be expanding into cinemas over the next couple of weeks. It's a new film from Sean Baker, who burst onto the scene with Tangerine a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, Helen, what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, this has gone massively up in budget in that it's not shot on an iPhone. It's shot on actually 35mm and has a movie star in it, in Willem Dafoe. Mm-hmm. So he plays the manager of a cheap Florida hotel near Disney's Florida, Disney World. And it's mostly not filled with the tourists that you might expect. It's mostly filled with the sort of what they call the hidden homeless. So these are people who can just about afford a room in a cheap motel. But that's it. They don't have any security. They don't have any apartments. They have to leave once a month so they don't build up any kind of residence rights at the hotel. And in this environment, you have a young mother called Hallie, who's played by Bria Venite, who Baker found on Instagram, amazingly. She's a first-time actor. Phenomenal performance from her. She's the mother to 6 or 7 year old Mooney, who's played by the astonishing Brooklyn Prince. An amazing performance. And it's basically sort of about their lives. It is largely plotless in that it's mostly about Mooney running wild with her friends during the summer holidays. They sort of, you know, they literally are unsupervised. They'll play pranks. There's a bit where they're spitting on somebody's car just because it's new and they can. There's a bit where they, you know, run off to look at some cows in a swamp. There's a bit where they go and explore an abandoned house. And, you know, you're always on edge for these kids. You are permanently terrified for them. And they're having a very nice time and have no worries whatsoever, except whether they can scam enough money from an ice cream from somebody, you know. So it's that contrast between that childish innocence and that absolute sort of blithe happiness and the very real, very high stakes that Hallie and Bobby are aware of and are trying to sort of negotiate a way through. It is genuinely phenomenal. I mean, the performances are like nothing you've ever seen. You don't disbelieve these people for a second. Defoe is heartbreakingly sort of empathetic and considerate, but it's really about this little family of Hallie and Mooney who are just, you know, they're on the verge. They're on the verge of disaster all of the time, and you just desperately want them to get through it.
I cannot wait to see it. I know we gave it 5 stars.
I did, yes. I concur with my own review.
You concur with your own review?
I do.
Okay, good. So 5 stars for that. I cannot wait to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but we will be having Sean Baker hopefully on the podcast when he comes into London in the next couple of weeks. And we fully endorse this movie. 5 stars in for the Florida Project. And it's no spoilers, I think, to say that the next film is also a 5-star movie. Hell of a week at the movies, if you discount every other movie but these two. it is, of course, Paddington 2, in which the little CG bear comes back and gets told to fuck off by a thief.
No, that's not what happens.
That's not what happens. So he's back. Paddington's back. He's badder than ever. What happens?
he's not bad at all. Aunt Lucy is about to turn 100. And obviously she's still in darkest Peru at the home for retired bears, and Paddington needs to send her the perfect gift, and he's determined to find something special. He, of course, is still voiced by Ben Whishaw. So he finds in his old friend Mr. Gruber's antique shop a unique pop-up book of London, and he thinks this is perfect. This will give her the feeling of being here in London. How wonderful. But it's an antique, it's a one-off, it's very expensive. So he has to try and save up enough money to buy it. But in the meantime, a dastardly person steals it.
Who could that
be? In related news, there's a dastardly person who lives on Paddington Street who's an actor called Phoenix Buchanan, played by Hugh Grant.
I'm not connecting to the two things.
I mean, there's very little between them, but yeah, he is there. So, yeah, one thing leads to another. Paddington ends up in prison and befriends, or does he, Knuckles McGinty, played by Brendan Gleeson.
Mm. Yeah, it all goes a bit Shawshank Redemption without the tunnelling through shit and... shivving. And
I think that was an original cut. An earlier, much darker
that's
cut.
That's the R-rated, like the fuck-off cut.
That's what they're going to call it. Paddington 2, the fuck-off cut. We've earned our explicit warning this week. Yeah. Sorry about that, everybody.
And do you know what? It's ironic that we're saying any of this because it is the nicest film.
It's lovely.
In ages.
It's a film about a bear wanting to buy someone a present, and that's kind of it. And the whole movie, he's just trying to buy a gift for somebody, and it's so sweet. And I mean, the first film was a big success, and with the sequel, there was probably a bit of temptation to do something spectacular, get out of London, take him to another country, or, you know, take him to space or something. But they keep it in London, and they keep it at the same kind of scale.
Yeah.
And
they don't just repeat the same sort of beats. You know, it's not Mr. Brown suddenly decides he doesn't like him again after all, and he has to win him over again, which I think a lot of sequels also do.
There are some brilliant kind of recurring. They go back to some of the gags from the original. Simon Farnaby's security guard character comes back. I don't think that's a spoiler. He's one of my favourite things about this series. But it's great. It builds on everything the first film did. I actually think it's better.
It is a phenomenal, phenomenal film. It is guaranteed, like, even if you think I am not interested in a film about a small bear, that is ridiculous. It is sweet without being schmaltzy, and I defy you not to be charmed by it. I can't imagine who isn't going to like Paddington and Paddington 2. I don't understand those people.
I mean, there's comedies these days, there's a lot of talk about, you know, this new type of improv comedy where the kind of Judd Apatow thing of everyone getting together. But everything in this movie, the jokes and the set pieces are so well written and so well executed, and the precision of the jokes. There's a set piece where he's trying to cut somebody's hair. He gets a job as a barber. We're in a barber shop, and it obviously goes massively wrong. But that sequence just had me in hysterics. It's so brilliantly executed.
Mm. Yeah, because there's so many ways it could go wrong. What's impressive is he manages to have all of them happen.
All of them.
Which is beautifully done.
Yeah, there's a real kind of Buster Keaton, Chaplin, those kind of silent comedy. There's those, they kind of, the set pieces that just build and build.
Yeah.
Full credit, I think, goes to the director and co-writer of the movie, Paul King, returning from the first film. And, you know, I think his confidence clearly increased after the first film, and I think you can see that here. Mm. This, for me, this is every bit as good as the first movie. It may be better for me. I found it more emotional than the first movie. And the first movie was a hugely pleasant surprise to me. I went in, you were talking about everything that could go wrong in the Paddington cuts someone's hair section. And I thought when I went to see the first movie, I thought everything can go wrong with this movie. And I wasn't looking forward to it. And I probably said this on the podcast before, but I sat down and I didn't want to be there, if I'm honest. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be watching this stupid movie about a CG bear that the trailer had come out and hadn't looked that great, and creepy Paddington had been a whole thing. And within the first 30 seconds, it charmed me. And within the first 30 seconds, I thought, oh, hang on a second. They know what they're doing. They've got me. And it's an amazing film. And the confidence really increases in this movie. And it's funnier than the first movie. Mm. It's more emotional than the first movie. The end of this destroyed me. Absolutely destroyed me, but in a nice way. It's not like in a Paddington gets his head cut off way. This will leave
spoiler.
You a wreck, but in a lovely way. I'm
spoiler,
not going to say
no
else.
Headless bears.
No headless bears in this one. It is beautifully, beautifully put together, wonderfully acted. You will fall in love with the bear. You will love marmalade sandwiches if you don't already. Great performance from everybody. Hugh Grant is so funny in this.
So good.
So is Brendan Gleeson. Nobody is wasted, literally and figuratively. It is fantastic. And the message of the movie about tolerance and politeness and heart and looking for the good in people.
And being nice to people and how
nice
that can change
people.
The world.
Mm. I think it was that kind of got me. Because, you know, everything going on in the world today, not many people being nice to each other, but the genuine sweetness of that bear and how it affects everyone else and how there's a ripple effect through all the other characters just coming from him is so great.
Yeah.
Loved it.
It's a phenomenal film. I absolutely loved it. I think we all did.
Yeah.
5 stars for Paddington 2. And we are going to be discussing it in a little bit more detail
because some bears just deserve their own spoiler special. And we're going to be doing that right after this. We record this show. We're going to have a Paddington 2 spoiler special. It's going to be up on Monday, November the 13th. And I sat down last week with the director, Paul King, and the co-writer, Simon Farnaby, to go through all the film's revelations. And there are quite a lot of revelations in this one. It's not like a Marvel movie, you know, but there's still quite a lot to talk about. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. Also out this week, we have Only the Brave, which is a true-life firefighting drama with an all-star cast, including Josh Brolin, Jeff Bridges, Miles Teller, and Jennifer Connelly. We gave that just 2 stars, I'm afraid. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by the stars of Mudbound, Garrett Hedlund and Jason Mitchell. And the star, or is he, of Justice League, Mr. Henry Cavill, Superman himself. But Superman's not in this film, I hear you cry.
And but Superman's not in this film.
You will hear us cry that to Henry Cavill. And it's his answer may shock you.
Does he not answer it?
He doesn't answer it. So look out for that must-listen interview next week, Henry Cavill, on the podcast. That is it. Until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Nick Desemlian.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to make some marmalade sandwiches with Lembas bread. Mmm, tasty. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.